Welcome to another episode of First Off, Let's Kill All the Lawyers. That 15th century Shakespeare phrase that drew raucous laughter at the time. And even today, when you bring it up, people think, yeah, it's not a bad idea. Maybe we could start wiping them all out one by one. I'm David Heffernan, and I've been practicing personal injury law here in South Florida for the last three decades. My goal behind this show is just simply to bring in friends of mine, other local lawyers, South Florida lawyers in varying aspects of the law, and to talk about different aspects of the law that have an impact on all of us. And this morning, I've got the great pleasure of bringing in not only a really, really good lawyer, but a very, very good friend of mine, classmate of mine. So I've known him for a long, long time. And by the way, one of the smartest guys I happen to know. This morning, let me introduce you to Will Morris. There you go. See?
Hey,
that's how you wrote it.
I was just looking around and seeing what you're talking about.
I mean, that's what your email said to say, right? No.
Oh, that's what I told you to say.
Exactly. I wanted to make sure I read it right. So Will and I go way back to graduating law school.
My God, it was what, 91?
91. So let's talk a little bit about you and why did you go to law school? And then I want to kind of go through your journey because it's been interesting because you've gone huge firm
right
to what you do now and right, covered all that base. But what was the interest in law for you?
Well, I as I tell people all the time, I never really had a choice. I mean, ever since I was 4 and 5 years old, that's what I was always told I was going to be. So, I mean, for example, I was born in South America, in a place called Guyana. And I was born as a British subject, so to speak, and, you know, and I spent some time in London, not only doing some studying, but also working as a lawyer. When I went back home and people asked me what I did for a living, and I told them I was a lawyer, nobody was impressed. Everybody was like, oh, okay. Give me $100. You know? So, yeah, I mean, now it was not a choice for me. And, yeah, we went to law school. I guess we started in 88.
Yeah.
And got out in 91. Then I went to, from law school at UM, I went to New York and practiced at this large firm called Baker McKenzie.
So let's talk about that because obviously you had decisions to make coming out and you went big firm. I mean, about as big as you can go. You went to New York.
The world at the time, yeah.
You went to New York, got licensed in New York. Yeah. And tell me about the practice in a firm and how big was Baker McKenzie at that time?
Well, Baker, if I remember correctly, at the time it had, I think, about 1,700 lawyers, close to 2,000 lawyers, around 50-something different countries in the world. And so it was humongous. And it was a typical – it wasn't – actually, the truth of the matter is it wasn't a typical big firm experience for me because I was the only person – I was the last person they hired in the litigation department. And so I – you know, as soon as I got barred, I was arguing cases. My first case was in the bankruptcy court within a year. You know, I was doing depositions and all kinds of cool stuff, which my – you know – The other lawyers in big firms in New York, I mean, young lawyers, didn't get that opportunity. I got a great story for you. This is how full of it I was. I mean, I remember this one time we go to this a hearing in federal court in New York. And you know how those big firms go to hearings. They go 5 and 6 deep. You have the lead partner, the senior partner. And then you have me all the way at the end. And we're sitting there at the table and they're arguing and they're going forward. And the other side, maybe it was White and Case or some other big firm like that. And they had the same sort of setup. And the judge asked a question. Everybody's stumbling around with the answer. Just turns out that I was the one who researched that issue and wrote that part of the memo. And I spoke up. I spoke up in the middle of this here, and you could see all the heads just swivel all at once. Right.
Who is that person? Is he with us?
Boy, I got my butt chewed for that. But I said, look, I knew the answer. What do you want me to do?
I was loving it with big firms like that, though, because I did some pharmaceutical litigation in the past, and they would hire great local counsel, but then there'd be a hearing, and they'd come in, and again, yeah, it's like lining up against Family Feud. You know, there's the guy. And by the way, the local guy knows more than any of them.
Exactly.
But they've flown in for a hearing. And I love it because they'd all fly in from New York. And, you know, we'd get a nice favorable ruling. Be like, okay, you guys have a nice flight back, you know. All right, so you do big firm, and then what draws you back to Miami?
It was sort of a personal family thing. My son, who was born while I was still in law school, we took him to New York, and he could not take the winter. The first winter, he spent weeks in the hospital. The second winter, he spent, you know, a couple of days in the hospital. And before the third winter got there, his mom said, nope, not happening, and brought him back to Florida. He was born here in Florida.
Okay.
And I stayed in New York for another year. And then after a while, I said, you know what, I need to be around my son. So I left. No plans to continue practicing law. It's just like I knocked around for a good, almost a year, not doing anything. And the great John Coranta, you know him, another friend of ours, went to school with, was working with Tom too at the time, and said, this lawyer from New York, where I went to school with, is just knocking around doing nothing. Why don't you come bring him in for an interview? So I go to an interview because, you know, John requested I do that, and I sat there and said, listen, I don't care. I mean, hire me, hire me. You don't. I don't care.
It's nice to go to a pressure-free interview where you're like, yeah, you know, if you want.
I was bartending, doing all kinds of stupid, fun stuff. And then they were like, well, okay, fine. We'll hire you. And like they say, the rest is history. I went from that Tom Tooth's firm to another boutique litigation firm. And I'm not going to get into the story why I left them, but I just left. One day I said, you know what? I quit. And I got up, and the next day I started my own firm. That was in 1999.
So. And been doing it since then at Morris Legal.
I've been doing it since. Well, there were several mutations of that. It started off with J. Will Morris, PA. Then it went to Morris DuPont Mansfield. Then it went to Morris DuPont. Then it went to Morris Barrow. Now it's just Morris Legal.
At least you're practicing with people you like now, right?
Exactly. You know, so yesterday I lost a hearing that I thought I should have won, and I, you know, how debilitating that could be at times. And I sat there for about half an hour, and then I realized it's 10 o'clock in the morning. You know, I quit. I got up and left. So I called my buddy David Howard. I said, you know what, I got fired. he goes, you got fired. I said, yeah, either I got fired or I quit because my boss is a real a-hole. And rather than curse him out, I just decided to quit. So I took the rest of the day off, and it was refreshing. And here I am.
Right. Well, good.
You have to lick your wounds to come back, you know?
it is a profession where, you certainly can't win them all. And the most devastating, I think, is those that, you know, you think absolutely should have. And, I mean, what appellate courts are for, and you know, judges try to do the right thing, but can't say that we always agree with them.
I know they came at me from left field, didn't see that coming. I thought, wow, okay.
All right, let's talk about your practice because it sort of evolved and you focused a lot on consumer law.
Yeah.
I think with that, there's a lot of things, the effect of the pandemic and everything else. So let's talk a little bit about that. You know, what happens?
I was fortunate enough that I saw the handwriting on the wall back in 2008, what was happening at the advent of the foreclosure boom. And I got involved with that and I started doing foreclosure defense and had, you know, huge amount of employees and huge amount of clients. And when that dried up, that sort of like led to the mutations of the firm that dried up. And here I am back to where essentially almost where I started before, but liking it better. So I think in the beginning of the pandemic, when things started shutting down and I started thinking, well, wait a minute, this might be, and again, only a lawyer could say this. I mean, that's going to be another boom of foreclosures. But the difference between then, now, and back in 2008 was even though the banks were being bailed out, they weren't necessarily, in 2008, and given money from the federal government, they weren't necessarily passing that down on to the homeowners, and homeowners were still out of jobs, and homeowners were still not being able to afford their rent, I mean, their mortgages. And so foreclosures were, you know, were the thing of the day. The pandemic was a little bit different because I don't see that same sort of a boom to the foreclosure market because I think because not only was everybody getting bailed out by the banks, by the government, but everybody was put in a holding pattern. I don't know what's going to happen in the next year or so, but I don't, I mean, there's a lot of people who've gotten deferring on their mortgage payments, and people haven't paid their mortgages since the beginning of the pandemic. I don't necessarily know what's going to happen once those deferments stop. I mean, certainly the economy looks as though it's not as bad as it was in 2008. It certainly looks as though it's bouncing back, and certainly there's a whole bunch of jobs available. And if you depend on who you listen to argue, it's not right. Enough people for those jobs. But so it's not really an economic crisis now. It's going to be just a crisis of whether or not the banks are going to say, you know what, for the year or change in which we deferred your mortgage payment, we're just going to tack it on to the end and not say to you, you know, you need to come up with a $50,000, $60,000 to bring your mortgage current. I don't think that's going to happen. And if that doesn't happen, then I don't necessarily foresee the same kind of foreclosure boom that occurred back in 08, 09.
So going back to 08 and 09, when that boom happened, I mean, what was everything going on with all the robo-signing? Because mortgages were just getting passed back and forth.
Right.
You know,
right.
To banks, you take out a mortgage with Bank A, and by the time anything happened, it was 10 banks later that has your mortgage.
Right. It's, sometimes in the closing, right after the closing, it gets transferred. And what happened was, and all mortgage documents give the lending bank the right to transfer it to whomever they want. What happened was that all these mortgages got bundled, you know, what they call tranches. And you'd have well-performing mortgages and poorly performing mortgages all put into a bundle. And they were being sold on the secondary market. But the problem is when one of the bad mortgages in that bundle went bad, then the whole bundle goes bad, right?
Okay.
And people who were buying those bundles in the secondary market started getting squeezed by it, you know? And then when you add to that the economy, the bottom falling out and people losing jobs and more mortgages became non-performing, then those tranches that they were called, those tranches of mortgages that were bundled together became almost worthless, you know, and banks were left holding the bag, you know. I mean, not to feel sorry for them. I mean, they're the ones who created the problem.
Right. They set it up.
because they wanted more mortgages to put in these tranches to sell in the secondary market. That's put pressure on the mortgage brokers to qualify anybody who with a pulse to qualify for a mortgage. I mean, I had situations where people are making $40,000 and $50,000 a year and carrying half a million and three quarter million mortgages. There's no way that could happen. You know, the general rule is you should only be paying 30% of your income to service a mortgage. Well, if you're paying 200% of your income to service a mortgage, you know,
it could be a problem. The math doesn't work.
The math doesn't work, you know. And then people start thinking, well, you know, I used to call them, I had a radio show back then, I used to call them Trumpets. People figured they were going to become real estate tycoons, you know, to buy a property and flip it, which a lot of people made a lot of money for it. But when the bottom fell out and you wind up holding a piece of property, it's not worth what you paid for it, then what do? You're going to go into foreclosure, right? So, I mean, that it started a domino effect. Look, there's a lot of blame to go around. I mean, sure, you can blame the homeowner for getting in a situation where they couldn't afford a mortgage to begin with. Sure, you can blame the bank. Sure, you can blame the regulations. You can blame a whole. But, you know, it was like a perfect storm, a confluence of all these small and seemingly insignificant events that created this big problem. And hence the 2008-2009 foreclosure boom.
So let's fast forward to today. And you say, obviously, foreclosures are way down and we don't see that. But what does a homeowner do that, let's say, lost a job during a pandemic or unable to work, or, you know, you've got people still long-term effects of COVID that haven't been able to go back to work? They get behind. What's their best option?
Well, like I was saying earlier, luckily there's a lot of banks are willing to, were willing. I don't know if they still are. And there were certain moratoriums in place that stopped foreclosures, you know, on the federal level. And there were many states had that as well. A lot of banks did that with a deferring of the mortgage payments. You know, I'm not ashamed to tell you, I took advantage of that. Why not? Right. So, the question is going to become, once these deferments run out, what the bank decides to do. No, there's no rule that says the bank could say, well, we'll roll it into the back. The same way there was no rule that said back in the 08 or 09 that you were entitled to a modification. There's no entitlement to it. There's no entitlement to the bank forcing the bank to put what you owe, what you haven't paid in the last year, and the back end of the mortgage. So it'll all depend on what these individual banks decide to do. I mean, if they decide not to and start putting pressure on people to come up with this kind of money, then we've got a major problem. And you imagine the government will have to step in and do something about it. Otherwise, we're back, maybe not to the levels of 2009 and 2008, but we're back to a little bit of a boom in foreclosures. You know, I mean.
Is there a difference because now, I mean, you go back to 08, 09, banks had the ability, like you're saying, it's their option. They can either work with you or they have the ability to foreclose on it.
Right.
But they didn't want to own a lot of these properties. The value wasn't there, everything else. Right now, the market's insane.
That's an interesting point.
And banks might want to say, hey, we can squeeze you now.
That's an interesting point. I mean, that's another part of the seemingly insignificant, the value of property is not necessarily insignificant because the values of property have gone ridiculously high. I mean, it's almost unsustainable. It cannot be sustained. There are banks now saying, look, we're not going to lend you money to buy this house because it doesn't appraise for the value you're paying. You know, I sold a place, my place in the before the pandemic and was looking to buy one. And shortly we recognized that I couldn't because, you know, the guy asked for 200. You go to the guy and say, can I pay you 200? The next day, a guy comes and says, I'll pay you 210. And you're right. And here's a briefcase of cash I got for it, you know, and you're done. And so banks are now looking at these properties that are being sold and saying, look, we're not going to finance that because that property's not worth it. So there's a writing on the wall that says that the boom in the prices, you know, they're either going to stabilize or have to come down. Now you make an interesting point because of that very same fact, that might motivate banks to foreclose and get REOs, what's called real estate owned, when the bank itself owns the property or selling the door courthouse there. But selling on the courthouse step that doesn't do the bank much because all they're entitled to really is what they're owed, right?
Right.
Right? And the surplus goes to the homeowner, right? The difference between what the property sells for and what you have to pay the bank off is called a surplus, and it goes to the homeowner. Unless the banks decide to take it back, you know, which again happened a lot back in 08, and which might happen again because if the bidding process on a foreclosure sale pushes the price above that which people are willing to pay, you know, and nobody buys it, then it goes back to the bank.
Right.
So the bank has to, there's almost a two-step approach for this to become an REO, real estate owned property by the bank. So while there might be incentives for the bank to foreclose, there's still a bit of a process to go through so they can reap the benefits of that profit. And by the way, which brings me to another point. You got a question?
Yeah. Well, no, I want to talk about now. You talked about a moratorium on foreclosure. So what is the status? Can they be filed or is there sort of a freeze on that?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like,
I'm asking you.
Well, no, you know, look, the federal government can put moratoriums on foreclosure on any property that's financed by FHA, you know, a federal agency, you know, and then it's up to the states to determine whether or not these particular states will put a moratorium on foreclosure. I don't think there is one, you know, I mean, last I checked, there wasn't. The reason I say it depends on who you ask. You know, like for example, there was a moratorium on evictions, right?
Right.
And obviously, on the federal level, that expired, and this different state there was a statewide moratorium on evictions, and which expired, and then the local governments have their own, you know, the local municipalities have their own moratoriums. So you know, while when the governor is saying one thing, and you know, you have to go check your local. Your county to see whether or not that really applies to you. It depends. It's all over the place. So, but I think I've seen an uptick in evictions. A lot of residential evictions, and I don't think a lot of commercial evictions as well. I've seen an uptick in that, and because quite frankly, you know, I mean, people weren't paying rent, and,
right.
And even though some of the landlords took advantage of the benefit, you know, those rental assistance programs that they had, that the federal government had, and even the state had, if you haven't been paying your rent, I mean, they still have a right to, you know, to evict you.
Yeah, and that's a whole different dynamic because, again, the rental market is so sparse down here that if people can get their property back to get people to come in and pay it, they're going to do it in a heartbeat. So, and I know there's some litigation now because, yeah, with the moratoriums on that, there were windows for a couple of days where it had lapsed and people filed right then and there. And now there's, you know, back in place. And you know, I guess we'll leave that to the courts to decide.
I mean, it's all over the place. It really is. I mean, you know, in the beginning of the pandemic, I had a guy come in and try to evict somebody from his residential property. And he got mad at me because it wasn't going anywhere. So he fired me and hired somebody else. And he still had it.
Right.
It was a year and a half later, I kept telling him, you know, what would you have me do? Would you have me go down to the courthouse and sign these orders myself? I can't do it.
Right. So
a year and a half later, he's still at it. Still at it. Can't get it done.
What do you see going on? You know, one of the byproducts of the pandemic, and you've been in big firms, but I know you do commercial work as well, is, you know, everybody started working at home, and now at least from law firms, and I talk to people, a lot of people are going, hey, we don't quite need the space that we had anymore because we can have half work at home. We can do this. And right. I think that whole dynamic's changing. Well, where do you see that going?
Yeah, all right, listen, it was inevitable. Once people start realizing, you know, like you don't really necessarily need to get up, get dressed and drive to a place, park and get into an office space with a whole bunch of other people. I mean, the requirement to have it is big, expensive. Real estate, you know, offices, you've seen those.
Well, that's your biggest nut, no question. Your overhead, right. That space.
I'm ridiculous. When you realize you don't need that, you can start cutting back on that. I mean, those big office buildings are going to start feeling the crunch. I mean, you know, I don't see it going back to where it was before. I mean, I hope and I pray, and I'm sure you think that too. I hope the courts don't go back to that fully. You know, I mean, you know, you know, sitting at your desk in your shorts and your tie and your jacket and shirt. I mean, and rather than driving, because I've always thought you know how the courtroom is. You go in there, there's 50, 60 lawyers. You sit around for an hour and a half,
right?
5 minutes of the judge's time, and you think about it. This is like $5 million an hour being clicked away for nothing.
Right.
You know, everybody's sitting there waiting. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. So I see big firms not getting back, you know, scaling down the space that they rent. I'm praying and I'm hoping that there's certain things in court that require your presence. I get that. You can't have a trial, which even though I've done a couple of Zoom trials, I mean, it's better in person, you know?
100%.
Yeah, but you know, ridiculous hearings, please.
But yeah, being able to do motion calendar, right. I agree with you 100%. Right. Just makes perfect sense.
Absolutely.
To do it via Zoom. You know, you're there. You can log in. You know, I can be in West Palm Beach for a hearing. Right. You know, at 8:30 and in my office at the same time without killing all that time. Otherwise, it took a whole morning. And you're right.
Right.
Yeah. The funny thing is, the one thing I've found, though, is with the Zoom hearings, it seems that lawyers are talking less before the hearings, okay? Because it's no big deal. I log in, and so instead of working out things ahead of time, because they go, well, I don't have to drive and be in Broward at this time, you know, can we work it out? They have a discussion. Those discussions are sort of falling by the wayside a little bit because it's a Zoom hearing. I could just show up.
Right, that's an interesting point. Not only that, you could talk to each other before the hearing and make a whole lot of progress. That's an interesting point.
Well, that is true. Yeah, how many times have you worked out something in the hallway?
That's right.
You know, waiting to see the judge going, "Hey, come on, this is ridiculous." You know, and you figure it out, and you write up an order, and you're out of there.
Right. That's an interesting point. Yeah, that is a casualty of the Zoom hearings. I agree. But I you cannot beat the convenience of it. I mean, you really, really, really can't.
No, I think that will be one of the good byproducts that comes out of this. And we've talked about it on this before. I really do credit the Miami-Dade County judges. I think they've done a really good job of keeping things open and via Zoom, however, virtually open, but continuing to try to move cases during this time frame as opposed to just letting it all sort of stall.
Right. You know, they've implemented, I've always thought it's a bit of a good thing they've implemented a system that's similar to the federal court where you have these case management and deadlines right off the bat. You know, federal court works. The minute you file it, 2 days later, you're scheduling a trial. You know,
right.
Wait a minute. I just filed. Why are we scheduling a trial? But that's how federal courts move their cases along. And I see Dade County is doing that now, which is, I think, a little bit of a good thing. I mean, rather than having these cases languish.
No question. And I've always, it's funny. I've always told my students that. I'm like, yeah, the difference between state court and federal court is in state court, you can kind of file and figure it out as it goes along. Federal court, you better have it wrapped, packaged in a bow and ready to go.
The day you
file it.
Right. They don't mess around over there. I mean, it's, you know, I tell people it's like real court, real court.
But yeah, I have seen now, you know, with the Zoom, I mean, I don't think I've had this many case management conferences in my life, because what judges were just doing is they're just setting monthly case management conferences going, okay, where are we at? What can we do to help, you know, and pushing things?
Well, it's sort of like they have to, because you remember in the beginning of the pandemic, everything shut down. Nobody was doing
right.
And these cases, you know, next thing you know, a 2019 case all of a sudden is 2 years old, right?
Right.
Doesn't go like that. So we have to do something to move these things along.
So, wait a minute. You're not telling me it's not March 2020 still? That's usually the last date I remember. I saw a great meme. It's two guys running and one guy's running here. And he goes, me still contemplating 2020. And then the guy behind him says, 2022, 4 months away. You know? It's been a blur in there for some of this. You know?
I tell people, do you remember April and March, April, and May of last year? Jeez. I mean, I was the only guy coming. I came to work every day.
Right.
It was like a ghost town, because I soon realized I can't work from home. I have to be, you know, get up and get dressed and go someplace.
Right.
And, it was a ghost town. It was like a strange, eerie, weird feeling, you know, but we lived through it.
Yeah, we did. We did. And you know, hopefully we've learned, and hopefully we will grow and continue to grow, and be very interesting to see what goes on in the world of foreclosure and everything else, and just how it might become.
You know, we'll see what happens, but you know, there's a couple of variables that have to play out to see what happens there. I mean, I banks hold all the cards. I mean, you know, they do. You know, the minute they have an opportunity to, they can say whatever they want to. You know, when I in the middle of foreclosures and trying to do modifications, people couldn't understand, why would the bank want my property back? You know, they don't care about you.
Right.
You think they know who you are?
Right.
You have coffee, you have beer with them. You're just a number and a piece of paper. And if it makes sense to them, that's what they're going to do. You know.
So what advice do you have for a consumer who all of a sudden is in a situation they can't pay their mortgage? I mean, and I know banks aren't moving swiftly on it, but should they be proactive? Should they contact the bank? Should they contact the lawyer?
I think you should contact the bank. You should contact the lawyer and start talking about it. I think banks will the modifications are not dead. I mean, you know, and so people should be proactive and contact the bank and say, listen, are we going to put this money I owe you in the back of it? Do we need to modify this? They have to keep on it. I mean, you know, or get your lawyer to keep on them so that, you know, you don't get caught off guard when the bank suddenly says to you, hey, by the way, we need a $50,000 check.
Right.
Otherwise, we'll foreclose the next month. Nobody has that. You know what I mean? Nobody has $50,000. But the good thing about it is that the property value is going up. People are not going to be as underwater as they were back in 2008 when the property values fell. That was another variable that helped the boom. Property value fell. You know, the guy who's going to flip a house, you know, thought he was going to make $20,000 from that. And the next, you know, he's $20,000 in the hole.
Yeah, he's upside down in it. Yeah,
like that. You know, and you can't do anything with it. You know, I mean, you know. So we will see what happens with the banks and what they decide to do. But the property value is being up. Then, you know, another option is to sell the thing. You know,
right?
But there's still that option. You know?
Well, that's an option. The only problem is then you got to find somewhere to live. Yeah. So, you know, you're going to sell. You're going to need to move out of Miami because
that's the other thing. You sell and go where, right?
Right. That's a big question. Well, Will, listen, it has been an absolute pleasure. Always love chatting with you and hanging out. And
anytime.
One of the cool things is, you know, that we've got a core from law school in 91 that continues to stay close friends and having dinner and drinks all that time. I wonder
if there's any other class that does that in our section. I don't think so.
I don't know. We're blessed to have the crew that we do. So, I'm blessed to count you as a friend and lawyer, and hopefully Will's one. We can start to take off the kill list now. You know, not a bad guy. Apparently, he can bartend if he's not working as a lawyer. So, you know, it's nice to know you got a good skill set.
Yeah. There's something to fall back on.
There you go. All right. Pleasure, my friend.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Nice. I appreciate you having me.
You got it, my friend. All right.
Thanks.
That's another episode of First Off, Let's Kill All the Lawyers, and we'll see you next week.